She knew she wouldn't be looking for God in the usual places or in the traditional sense even. But after the birth of her first child, she felt the tug to go on a spiritual journey to be ready for when her daughter popped that big question in life, is there a God? Anjali Kumar is a first-generation Indian-American author. She's an attorney for the post-cable financial news network Cheddar. She's also an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School. Anjali Kumar's new book is called Stalking God, My Unorthodox Search for Something to Believe In. Anjali, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you started a journey to find something to believe in, this higher meaning, and you classified yourself as a nun, that is an N-O-N-E. What should we know first about people who classify themselves as nuns?
Well, that's a really good place to start, and it's definitely N-O-N-E. I'm definitely not an N-U-N. It's a really large group is what you should know, and that it's an increasing group. But one of the things that I think people don't realize about nuns is that we're often spiritual, and that many of us still believe that there is something out there, that there is a God, but we're just not sure who it is. And so the number of us is growing rapidly.
So I would think that this would be an aimless bunch of people, not perhaps thinking deeper thoughts, but you say that's not true.
I mean, I can't speak for everyone. Certainly, it's probably a very, very diverse group of people, just like our country. But in my case, it was definitely not true. I didn't feel aimless or not rooted necessarily. I just hadn't really thought about it much, about what I believed, about the bigger questions, about what I believed about religion and spirituality until I had my child almost 8 years ago. And when when she was born, I just realized I didn't really know what I thought about these things. I didn't know what I believed about religion and spirituality because I had just never done the digging, apart from kind of intellectually. And so it set me off on this journey that lasted many years and will probably be for the rest of my life, trying to figure out what I believe so I could answer questions for her and give her some spiritual mooring.
Why do you consider yourself not the typical candidate for this expedition to find a higher power? You're not a religious philosopher. You don't oversee a church.
Right. I think for exactly those types of reasons. I work in tech and startups, as you mentioned at the top. I'm the general counsel and chief people officer for a company called Cheddar, which is a startup here based in New York, and have worked at other startups before that, largely in legal roles. I worked at Google for 6 years. So I spend my time with all these folks that are engineers and doctors and lawyers and, you know, not necessarily the group of people that you think of as being spiritual seekers, not the most obvious pool of people. And so given that background, I think I'm a bit of an unusual person to peg a journey like this too. And I hope that that gives my readers something to hold on to, that they're not alone, you know, that you don't have to be, you know, in the wellness or into the woo-woo to explore these questions and to think about them.
Yeah, you make it accessible, and you also show the missteps, perhaps,
yeah.
that you don't have even answers going in. You started with a pretty clean slate, if you will, but at the same token, you grew up surrounded by religion. Is that right?
I did indeed. So I actually grew up near Wisconsin, not so far away, just on the other side of the border, down in Illinois, in the suburbs of Chicago. And I was raised by Indian parents. We were Jain, which is a small religion. There's only a few million of us in the United States. 0.00046% of the population in America is Jain. But I was raised culturally Hindu. But then I also went to Catholic school growing up from first grade till fifth grade. So I was almost surrounded by too much religion, I suppose, in some ways. But it was something that was all around me and very comfortable. It wasn't something that I rejected as a kid. I was really fascinated by it. I was, you know, in church. To this day, if I go to a wedding or any kind of church service for any reason, I know the entire service by heart. Like, I know everything. And my husband finds it very funny when I'm like, get up, sit down. You know, I know the whole thing. And I repeat it with the priest and I know the whole drill. But I was surrounded by it, and it was very comfortable, but it didn't really have a deeper meaning to me. It was more stories and cultural.
More ritual, and, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And something that I didn't feel the need to reject, but I just didn't really understand what it meant for me.
You couldn't see the connection between these rituals, knowing when to stand, recite, sit down, and where that connected to these much larger universal questions. So before we go on this journey of where you went around the world, let's bring in your TED Talk, because it dropped yesterday. Your birthday, I saw on that social media, so revealing. But, you know, you talk about this quest to find God, and this is a quick 15 minutes. You offer a snapshot of your journey, boils down to your discovery. In it, you talk about taking people's requests to a healer, and you talk about how people from diverse places and families seek the same kind of love. Let's listen to the way you describe it.
They all asked for the kind of romantic love, the soulmate that we read about in epic romantic novels, the kind of love that will stay with us till the end of our days. Sorry, that's my husband. Crap, now I forgot my place.
So a moment there that to me, really revealing though of how you even approached your book, that there are little reveals here and there, but it's a journey that unfolds, and even a TED Talk that unfolds in the moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that moment was quite funny. I'm glad it went well in the end, but I was so thrown. I just happened to lock eyes with my husband as I was talking about sort of this undying love and that thing. And I saw him crying, and then I got quite choked up, and I was like, oh man, like, you're throwing me off on my big moment of my talk that I've been rehearsing for months. But it was a really human moment. And I think that's what resonated about that. And I'm glad they kept it in and they didn't edit it out. It was actually one of my favorite moments of the talk.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Anjali Kumar. Her new book is Stalking God, My Unorthodox Search for Something to Believe In. You can join this conversation about spiritual journeys at 800-642-1234. What is your story? What did you do to find out about yourself, about finding religion? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WP. PR Mornings. Something else, Anjali, about that TED Talk was the humanness that you just brought up, of being human, about making mistakes, if you will, or things not going quite as planned. And you set off in this journey and going to these different places all around the world, but you found humans, you found people, you found you know, the Wicca. Tell us about some of the people you met on this journey.
You know, I had people were so incredible on this journey, and I was very open about what I was doing. When I realized this was turning into a project and a book, I was super transparent. I suppose the lawyer in me was very worried about you know. I was very, very transparent, and I would make sure that people knew that I was doing it. I changed everyone's names where they requested it, et cetera, and, you know, any identifying details. But I tried to really stay true to the heart of the journey and what I was doing. And if there is humor in the experiences, to make sure that it was really about me and my experience, as opposed to making fun of anyone else, because that wasn't the point of the journey. The point being that we are all human, that we are all seeking, whether we admit it or not, that we're on these different paths, because otherwise, what's the point? If there's not something bigger, then what are we all doing here? How do you explain all these, you know, the things that are happening in the world, the good and the bad? There must be something bigger. And so my path and the things that I saw and the people that I met, I think, just reiterated that all along the way. People were incredibly kind and gracious and open about their own experiences. They were whispering, you know, whispering their ideas to me about what I should do, or shouting from the mountaintops in some cases. Even since the book has come out, I've gotten so many emails and tweets and sort of different communications of people wanting to share what they've learned on their journey, or just to, you know, reflect back something that resonated for them in the book that I that means a lot to me, because I think it just gives people either permission to do some of these things, or perhaps saves them from some money from doing some of the other things that were a little bit less successful for me personally, or at a minimum just gives, you know, the readers a laugh if they're not really into the seeking of it. Hopefully there's something there for everybody.
The witch's potluck stands out. You baked chocolate banana muffins to take to a witch's potluck. The muffins didn't work out too well. You went anyway. What stands out to you from that evening in New York?
You know, it was such a humbling experience, and that I think that was one of the experiences that I went in with a lot of preconceptions, and they were really childish misconceptions, and it really taught me a lot about my own prejudices and my own biases, and my own unconscious bias. That term's thrown around a lot, but I think I had an unconscious bias towards the Wiccan community, and I didn't even know it until I went into it. And when I got there, I was like, wow, I'm very humbled by how open and welcoming this group of people were, and how much they were just like me. You know, like everybody is kind of the same. It's like we're a group of diverse New Yorkers, an incredibly kind group of people, and everybody just wanted community. And I think that's one of the common threads through so much of this, is that people are really seeking community. And that, those are things that, you know, perhaps were more readily available when we lived closer to family, when we didn't move to places like New York and leave our family and our tribe behind, as it were. Or certainly for my family back in India, where, you know, people lived in community and joint houses and all of that. And people are now seeking it in these really different situations from what we're kind of meant to be in. And so a lot of this, I think, is people looking for community.
You found that night that one woman told you she'd do a spell to work to ensure your book would succeed. Did that moment surprise you? Take us there.
Yeah, you know, she was so lovely, and she just came up to me because when we were going around the table talking about, you know, our year and what we were grateful for, I sort of fumbled because I wasn't quite prepared to share anything deeply personal, and I sort of stumbled through it, and then I mentioned that I started writing this book, again, part of my transparency, but also just because that's what I was working on at the time. And she came up to me asked me a little bit about it, and then she was like, well, I'll do some spell work for you. And I was so taken aback by it, because I was like, that's such a wonderful gesture, you know, because she didn't even know me, and she'd never see me again. I've literally never seen this woman again, but I believe her. I believe that she went home and, you know, did a spell casting, or maybe we'll do it now, and I guess we'll see. If it becomes a bestseller, then I know it worked.
But she wanted to do something that she could do. She wanted to go home, be productive, and that productivity could then yield something good for you.
Yeah, that it was such a selfless act. You know, it's like there's nothing in it for her, and it was just the idea that, you know, I think people are just inherently kind. That's another thing that I've definitely learned on this journey, is that the world is largely a kind place. We just don't focus on that as much as we should.
She went to a sweat lodge, befriended people who practice the Wiccan religion. Her international journey to find deeper meaning to life's big questions brought her to India, to Mexico, Japan, and closer home to Soul Cycle in New York for a sweaty workout with some multitasking, finding your soul. The book is Stalking God, My Unorthodox Search for Something to Believe In. Anjali Kumar stays with us. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you gone on a spiritual journey? What is your story? What did you find out about yourself? What did you find out about religion and belief? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in just a bit. She sought out healers, spiritualists, and psychics. She considers herself half witch after exploring the Wiccan religion, but still in pursuit of the other half. She explored the laughing yoga movement and tried to see if religion could soothe the heartache of miscarriages. Anjali Kumar is a first-generation Indian American author. She's also an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School. Her new book is called Stalking God: My Unorthodox Search for Something to Believe In. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you gone on a journey to find answers to life's big questions? What did you find? Have you felt the urge to find more meaning in life, especially after big events in your life? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to George now, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My message would be that, you know, I'm also a non, and that I think so often most people take the look at a non-person as somebody who's really not a very good person. And what I try to do is draw off of the really good people on this earth. And even Jesus, even if I don't believe he's the Son of God, I believe that what he taught was really a great way of living your life. And so I look at people such as Jesus or Gandhi or Martin Luther King as great examples of how to be a very spiritual person and doing good while you're on this earth.
George, thanks for calling in. Anjali, your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with George. Thank you so much for calling in. That's exactly right. I think that's, to me, so much of the point is that all of these different faiths, all of these different people are embodiments of the same principles, right? Like these people that we look to in different religions or in different, as leaders of different movements, it's because they're embodying these same qualities that we all kind of universally know to be good things. And so if we can focus on those things and the things that actually make us bind us together more than what makes us different, I think we'd be a really far along.
Let's go to another piece of your book, the Mexican Sweat Lodge. How can you explain your time in a Mexican sweat lodge, and what was that experience like?
It was very, very hot. It was exceedingly hot, uncomfortably hot. So I should contextualize this by saying I'm not a fan of extreme heat. Even though I'm from India, I was raised in Chicago, right? Like suburbs of Chicago. I was raised in the cold.
Air conditioning.
I'm used to the cold, right? So it's not, I'm not used to the extreme heat growing up outside of Chicago. So I went to the sweat lodge. It ended up being a bit of a tourist thing, admittedly, which I talk about a bit more in the book, but it was on the beaches of Mexico, absolutely beautiful. It was a little bit of a break in between jobs. And I was down there with a few friends of mine and decided to go into the sweat lodge. There's a whole set of reasons that sort of led up to it, where I was feeling very open to new experiences. And I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to embrace this, you know, traditional Mayan sweat lodge. And it ended up being kind of anything but. But the thing that was great about it is that it really helped me reflect back to myself that I wasn't really doing a lot of these experiences in the best way, right? Because I was going as a tourist and I wasn't embedded in the cultural traditions that would lead one to go to a sweat lodge. So me kind of bouncing around doing all these things and dipping in and out of different experiences that had really rich cultural traditions behind them was a bit irresponsible and not necessarily giving me an accurate picture of what it was like to embrace some of those traditions. And so it was instructive in a lot of ways. And so even though I was getting those sorts of pieces out of it as opposed to necessarily communing with a higher power.
There was
a woman who had a baby in the sweat lodge. I mean, it's like a whole thing. And she had her cell phone in the sweat lodge. Like it was a whole thing, but made for a funny chapter, I guess, in the end. So
how could you have been better prepared for these experiences? Because after all, you were going in eyes wide open.
Yeah, I think it was a challenge, you know, so I think a lot of these are meant to be accessible to you and I and or to anyone. But then some of them, you know, something like going to Peru and meeting with a shaman and doing something like an ayahuasca, which is a DMT substance, like a plant medicine. But it's used in various spiritual traditions down in Peru or down in the Amazon. And there's a whole diet that goes with it. There's a way of living that is really associated with it. And so my coming in from New York after being in this sort of crazy work situation, running, you know, going down there, not having prepared my body for it, not having prepared my mind for it, was just not the best way to go into it. It's like you have to go in having done that preparation. There's a reason that there's a protocol leading up to something like that. And so I think those things were really instructive for me and hopefully for a reader who might be contemplating any of these things.
You touch on something interesting there because people have these daily demands. There's a lot of noise in people's life, from jobs to family, meeting expectations in many areas, groups, organizations. You know, how the spiritual journey is very different from that. You are taking time away from all of those demands. How do you respond to criticism that not everyone can go and have these discoveries and these global travels to find deeper meaning?
Yeah, it's a really fair criticism. I think if you read it carefully, you'll see that a lot of the journeys that I did were most of them were tied to things I was already doing or a trip I was already taking. So it was conflated in with work because I too was working full time. I had a job at Google. I had a job at, you know, a startup at Warby Parker. I was really busy. I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter. I have a lot of obligations. So it wasn't like I was just gallivanting around. I know it can seem that way, but that's also the tone of the book, is to make it feel a bit more light. Me telling everyone the logistics of how I got everywhere would probably make for a very uninteresting read. But in most cases, like for example, when I went to Japan, I was there for a conference. I was in Osaka for a sustainability conference. And then Kyoto is a 2-hour train ride. And I went there for the weekend before having to continue on to Hong Kong for work. So these things were baked in or bookended by other things that I was already doing for work or for personal travel. So I wasn't just like, you know, checking out of my life and hightailing it around the world. The only thing that I did specifically that I really took time away from my family in a more intentional way was a silent meditation retreat. And that's, you know, the last big chapter in the book. And I did that when I was on leave from work writing the book and took only 5 days away because 10 days was still way too much. So I get it. I totally understand. It's not an easy thing to do. That's why I did it for you, you know, so that you can maybe read through and say, okay, most of the stuff isn't for me, but that one thing sounds interesting, so I might try that.
5 days of silent meditation, that's still a lot. How did you manage that stillness?
It was one of the most challenging things I've ever done in my life, and it was also one of the most rewarding. I think, you know, as you were saying earlier, we're so busy. We're running around so much. We confuse motion with accomplishment. I'm very guilty of that. I'm probably the inventor of that idea of confusing motion with accomplishment, and being forced to really stop and just be still and not have any of the normal identifying markers of yourself. You're not telling anyone your stories. You're not saying who you are, where you come from, anything. You're just being, being still. And not being anyone for anyone else in that time, it was scary. It was incredibly liberating. And it ended up being a very powerful experience for me.
Let's go to Tracy now, who joins us from Muskego. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, good morning. I'm loving this topic, and I think I need to read this book because it really speaks to me. Spirituality has been, I feel, for myself, journey throughout many years of my life. And I was born Catholic, but and raised that way for the early part of my life, but I feel like I've just kind of dipped my toes into other belief systems and other religions throughout the years, and it's just kind of brought me to this place where I have kind of my own mixture of spirituality. And a lot of it, I believe, has helped me cope with things that have come up in my life. I was widowed at the age of 38, and I really feel like my spirituality at that time is what helped me cope with that. I had an Indian Native American medicine woman that I met with and spoke with at that time, and she helped me through that. And I had a great yoga teacher who helped to, you know, just give me another perspective on life and death. Also, so I just feel like all of the things I've learned from other religions has helped me kind of pull together my own spirituality.
Tracy, thanks for the observations. Anjali.
Well, thank you so much, Tracy, and I'm so sorry for your loss. I think what you described is very much the journey that I went on, and I hope you'll enjoy the book, because I think it'll probably reflect back to you a lot of things that you've experienced as well. You know, I think part of why I sort of jokingly refer to myself as a half witch by the end of the Wicca chapter, it's not because I'm going around doing spell casting work or anything like that, but it's like the idea of Wicca that is a bit of a choose your own adventure kind of religion, right? Like there is no book, there are no rules. And so I don't actually consider myself a Wiccan, but the idea that I've sort of pasted together all these different traditions and belief systems into something that is a bit of a bricolage and like works for me is where I landed in the end. And so I'm still Jain and Hindu. I still identify myself that way if I was, or none, but or otherwise as one of those things, because that's the tradition I came from. That's something that's easy to pass on to my daughter. It's still my culture. My husband's Indian. So all of our kind of religious spiritual traditions, our rituals are still based in that. But the other bits and bobs are kind of from all over the place. And yeah. So I meditate, but I also, you know, I do all sorts of different things of what works for me.
But you still are quite this work in progress, as we learn in the book, that you have you find this religious tapestry, and yet the big questions are still unanswered.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I wish I had come by the end. I mean, look, I'm a lawyer. I like knowing stuff. I like having the answers to things. And I had hoped that naively, I think, that I would have this clear map for myself, for my daughter, for my family to say, here's the answer. I really figured it out. I'm pretty convinced it's this. All data points to that, or whatever it would be. And that's not what happened for me. And I envy people who have that absolutism, that really have figured it out. But I'm really okay with not knowing.
Let's go to Jim now, who joins us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Go ahead.
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I just have a little caution to give to you. I've been doing this since my early teens. I say unfortunately, but that's not really my feel on it. My feel is that anything worth having is worth working for. What I would say, there is so many of us that are on a similar path, and everybody has this heart-driven opinion of what it is and how it is, and I would say to be careful about taking in the noise. What I found is that the higher power tends to direct us and have a very soft voice, a very soft light touch, and to let yourself be guided by the quiet directions, not so much the noisy one.
Jim, thank you so much. Picking up on the nuance, Anjali?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think I found that to be true too. And things like meditation have helped me a lot, just getting really quiet with myself, trying to block out a lot of the noise and the chatter and the frenetic running around turned out to be a really good place for me. And part of me, you know, it's people keep asking me like, well, what are you doing next? What's next on the list? I'm like, no, I think I'm good for a while. You know, I think I did a lot, and I think I just need to be still and let the answers come when they're ready and reveal themselves to me.
Could you introduce us to this person you met, Jain of God? Who is this man?
So he is what's considered a full trance medium, which basically means he can talk to dead people. But in his case, it's a very specific group of dead saints and doctors that he claims he channels and then heals people through. He's based down in Brazil, and a lot of people believe very fervently that he can cure cancer, that he can he can do all sorts of healing acts. So I went down there many years ago, about 7 years ago, to see him, and it was one of the initial things that kind of set me off on this journey. And so it was fascinating. And the people who are down there come from all over the world, obviously including Brazil, definitely a lot of Americans, but from all over the world, looking for health and looking for answers and for healing. And a lot of people feel that they've gotten it.
And there's some surgery involved as well?
There is. So he does what's called invisible surgery, which is, I guess, psychic surgery. I'm not fully informed on how it works at the metaphysical aspects of it. My husband is a doctor, and so he really rolls his eyes whenever this comes up. But yeah, he claims to do surgery. He does do some physical cutting down in Brazil, but I've been told by people close to John of God that that's because it's not because the surgery, the physical surgery, is required to heal you. It's because some people who come there believe that they need to see a scar or have that physical act in order to believe that they've been healed. So that's why he doesn't.
What are some of the ideas you have to accept, blindly accept, if you will, to understand John of God?
I mean, I guess it's, isn't it faith? I guess it's believing that through a man, through a regular man, that acts of healing can occur. And I personally am not so sure that it worked, but I will say that my asking to have fun down there, my wish ends up being that I hope I can have more fun in every aspect of my life, like something akin to that. And I have to say, ever since then, I've definitely found humor in things that I wouldn't have expected to find. And so maybe it came true.
Were you changed by that experience?
It's a good question. I think I was really humbled by the faith that I observed around me, because the people who were there, a lot of them really deeply believed, and you could see that they were transformed by what they had experienced. A lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people. And that's really beautiful, like, that people find that. And it's not like he's hurting them. It's not like they're, you know, they're not spending a ton of money to be down there or anything. It doesn't feel, you know, maybe people are being scammed, but it doesn't feel like it. And it's not really for me to judge. And, you know, even if they're coming away feeling better about their lives or feeling like they have a fighting chance with the disease or something like that, feeling emboldened in some way, maybe that's not a bad thing.
Anjali Kumar went on a personal spiritual journey after the birth of her daughter, but the journey was more about being ready to answer her daughter's big questions once that time came. And no amount of Googling or asking Siri could get to the answer to the meaning of life. The book is Stalking God. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever felt like you were stalking God? How did it go? What did you find and what did you explore along the way? Where are you at now? Are you still stalking, or do you consider yourself Anon, as Anjali described, starting from scratch with religion? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in just a minute to the Ideas Network. On a transcontinental journey to find religion, spoiler alert, Anjali Kumar did not ultimately come up with all the answers. Yet each experience encountering healers, encountering spiritualists, psychics, befriending new people around the globe, it helped her understand that the secret to any form of spirituality lay in the magic of ritual, of belief, and that hope, the hope it offers people. She found love. Anjali Kumar stays with us. The book is Stalking God, My Unorthodox Search for Something to Believe In. Have you been stalking God? What is your story? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Anjali, I want to go back to a point in your book where you reveal to us that you were dealing with miscarriages and trying to answer questions of when to try again, how do I go from here? How do I heal and go on from a miscarriage? How are those medical experiences also playing into this journey you're taking of spirituality and then ultimately having a baby?
Yeah, I think they played into it so much more than I even realized going into it. So, you know, the jumping off point for the book and for the research was having the baby. But prior to having Zia, I had miscarried three times. And I think when I was finally pregnant with Zia, I didn't really allow myself to get excited about being pregnant or really bond deeply with her until I was much further along in my pregnancy, probably just because of the trauma of those miscarriages from before. And then having her and of holding her in my arms for the first time, I just found myself completely unprepared for what came next. You know, I was like, oh, wow, I'd been spending so much time trying to get pregnant. I hadn't really thought about what it meant now to be a mother. And that, you know, I think part of the journey was trying to figure that out too. Even though the book is not about parenting necessarily, or not just about my being a parent and my relationship with my daughter or with my husband, but, you know, I think the miscarriage has absolutely played into my questioning whether or not there's more. I think anyone dealing with loss, like the caller earlier, those sorts of deep losses, can't help but make you question things.
Let's go to Mary now, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Go
Thanks
ahead.
For taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you know, I had a spiritual journey at a pretty young age. I was raised a Methodist Christian and never really understood anything that they were trying to tell me. And it was a lot of stories and Bible stories, and I didn't understand the significance or the meaning. So I actually looked into Wicca and like junior high, just because I needed some kind of meaning for life. And I went to a church camp, and because my parents told me I needed to, and I came back a changed person, and still had a lot of questions. I still needed some answers to some really tough questions about why Christians believe what they believe. And luckily I had a very intelligent friend who helped me out and started studying theology in the eighth grade, and found out those answers as best as possible, and have continued on my Christian path since then. I'm so happy that I did, because if she hadn't have been able to answer those questions, I probably would have been agnostic.
Mary, thank you for the call. Your reaction, Anjali?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's beautiful that she found her way back to the faith that she was raised in, and that that became meaningful and deep for her, and provided those answers. And I think, you know, how lucky, you know. So I think it's just, but I really do believe that all of these different traditions are kind of paths to the same thing, and it's just how you interpret them, what works for you, what culturally works for you, is what resonates for you. But at the end of the day, if you really get to the core of religion, and again, I'm certainly not a theologian or an expert on any of this, but just in my own reading and understanding of it as a layperson, it seems to me that they're all getting at the same core things. And, you know, as I said, you mentioned the TED Talk, that's what I found even sort of unexpectedly when I kind of looked back on the entire experience, realizing that everyone is looking for the same things and everybody wants the same things in their life.
Mary, thanks. Let's go to Bob now, who joins us from Chicago. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I've been on a spiritual search all my adult life. The question of God's existence is so big, I realize that a black and white answer is not given to humans. So what I try to do is to study the question every day, mostly by reading about it, sometimes by talking with others. And the answers I came to is that we get clearer about the question of God, and we could make the concept more meaning, and we should try and make more meaning about the question of God and every other part of our lives every day as much as we can.
Bob, thanks so much. And the meaning isn't black and white. It's not that stark, Anjali.
Yeah, I agree. That's certainly been my experience. You know, I wish it were. It'd be so much simpler, wouldn't it? If it was just like, this is the answer, and everybody just fall in line. But that's not the way the world works.
What else do people want? Is it world peace? Is it riches? What did your sample of hopes and dreams reveal?
So when I went down to John of God, there's a whole experience that you can have where you basically present him with wishes, almost like he's a genie in a bottle, and you can ask for three things. And in that in the lead up to that, I started telling people I was going down there and offered to carry their wishes down with me. And the commonalities of the wishes that people sent me from all walks of life. I mean, I get that I had a limited data set of my friends and family and their friends and friends. So it was somewhat not a demographically balanced sample by any stretch, but still the similarities between what people were asking for were quite staggering. And what I found in that research, if you can call it research, or that analysis, was that everyone was looking for health, happiness, and love. And the way they asked for it, the tone of what they were asking for, what it really meant when you boiled it down, was incredibly similar. And I found that to be a beautiful revelation that I wasn't expecting, and a very humbling revelation in my experience.
What can people who don't believe in God take away from your pilgrimage?
I think, you know, if they really don't believe in it and it's not something that they struggle with, I hope that they just enjoy the book, you know, that it is a bit of an offbeat journey, and that hopefully, you know, the levity of the of how I approach the topic gives them something to laugh to, or maybe it gets them to think about something a little bit differently. I don't think you have to be a true seeker to read this book. I think of myself as a bit of a professional curious person, and so this was just the topic that I was curious about for a number of years, and so that's what led me on this journey. But it's definitely, you know, something that's a thread through my career, even of trying new things, of going into new companies, into industries I've never worked in before. And so that's really the lens with, you know, with which I enter into each of these experiences. So if nothing else, hopefully it is intriguing to a reader from that perspective.
Perhaps we're hardwired as humans to search for something that is greater than ourselves.
Yeah,
Did you find others who, as you went to these places around the world, were others there searching for something?
So many people were searching. And I have to admit, when I first started it, I was doing it very quietly. And I thought, people are going to think I'm bananas. You know, like they're going to think that I've gone off the rails. Like I had this baby and like I'm suffering from some sort of, you know, crazy postpartum situation.
Postpartum, sure.
And it was really interesting that as I started talking about it a little bit more, people were intrigued. And again, a lot of these folks were people like doctors, lawyers, engineers. I worked at Google at the time. My husband's a doctor. So we're surrounded by folks like that. And people always wanted to talk about it. And I don't think it was just because I told a good story. It was really because they were intrigued, or because they were sort of secretly on their own path and searching. Things like meditation back then weren't as mainstream as they are now. I mean, if you can call it mainstream at this point, but it's certainly on the coasts, I think there's much more acceptance and openness to things like meditation. And I think you're seeing more and more of that. But 7-8 years ago, you know, when I started meditating, people were like, what are you doing? Like, what is that all about?
And 7-8 years is such a short time when you really think about it, a blip.
Yeah, it really is. It's gone by so quickly. But the openness, like things like the wellness community, the emergence of those sorts of conversations, I think those things have just exploded. So I guess the book is coming out at the right time because the country and the world feel more ripe for these kinds of conversations.
Take us, if you will, to Burning Man, a real difficult festival to describe because different people attend this famous gathering for their own reasons. What is this, Burning Man?
So I will try to do it justice, but with the very giant caveat that my experience is a data set of one. And I think what's fascinating about the Burning Man is that it is a completely different experience for everyone who attends it. In fact, I was talking to a friend of mine who went to Burning Man at the same time that I did, and she kind of peppers through the chapter of Burning Man because we kept running into each other and sort of exploring it together. She was just saying the other day to me about this piece of art that she saw. She was like, oh, and remember the big sculpture that was floating and turning? And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, you didn't see that? And I was like, I never saw this piece of art the entire time that we were there. And we were just laughing that we actually spent a decent amount of time together on that journey, but I completely missed this giant piece of art that she had spent a lot of time around, and that was such an anchoring experience for her, but I never saw it. And I think that kind of captures the essence of Burning Man, is that everybody has a totally different experience. It's basically, I called it a conference because I didn't know how to explain it to my parents, but a conference, but it's not a conference. It's like nothing like a conference, but it's a gathering of people. So that's the only, if the definition of a conference is a gathering of people, then it's a conference. But it's about 70,000 people who go out in the Nevada desert a few hours outside of Reno every year for what is basically an 8-day festival, and in a temporary city. And so over the course of that time, a city kind of pops up and then disappears with no trace left behind. Mm. And it's just, it's absolutely fascinating. The logistics, I know this sounds super nerdy, but the logistics of it are absolutely incredible. I don't know how they pull this off every year. It's really, really extraordinary. And then at the sort of the marquee event at the end of the week is that there's two things. One is that they burn the man, which is this giant effigy, 70-foot tall effigy, and they like light off fireworks and burn this as sort of a symbolic burning of the man. And then the next night they burn the Temple of Promise, which is where a lot of people will go to mourn the dead and to put their prayers into, and it sort of becomes like this giant communal funeral pyre is the way I describe it. But the whole thing, it's, there's a ton of art, and the whole ethos of it is gifting. There's no money that's exchanged. You don't pay for anything once you're there. I mean, there's a ticket cost and that sort of thing, and obviously the logistics of getting there and setting up camp. But you, once you're there, it's not like you're buying and selling things at all. It's a really bizarre universe. You know?
In our final moments of the conversation, let's try to fit in Jennifer here in Madison very quickly. Jennifer, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted, I was wondering if you would like to comment on the idea of, we kind of have set up our current sort of political and social climate, this dichotomy between science and religion or spirituality as ways of finding and making meaning or striving towards truth. And I don't know if they're so different. And I guess I'm wondering what her thoughts are on that.
Jennifer, thanks. Anjali, go ahead in our final moments.
Yeah, it's so complicated. I think what's happening in the world around us is that we are spending so much time focused on the things that divide us as opposed to the things that bind us together. And I don't know what place there is for religion and spirituality in that conversation. I think it's become such a divisive, loaded topic because people are so hell-bent on what they believe being right and being true that nothing else can be true. And I think that's sort of the fundamental problem. And if we could just take a step back and really focus on the things that unite us, I feel like we'd be in a different conversation right now.
Anjali, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anjali Kumar, her new memoir is Stalking God, My Unorthodox Search for Something to Believe In. She is a first-generation Indian-American author. She's an attorney for a post-cable financial news network called Shudder, an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School. And you can continue the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This hour, the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Dave Potras provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.